Well, we're here once again, glad for the presence of everyone. This is the fourth and final sermon of this little meeting. Let me tell you, this is kind of a tough deal for someone who doesn't do this on a routine basis. But I want to say I appreciate very much the opportunity to come here. Appreciate very much Eric and Tara letting me stay at their house. We kicked Evan out of his room, so sorry, Evan, that's the way it goes. Appreciate very much the lunch today and the attendance. It's been very good. We've had people every night. Good to see Danny here. Good to see Joe again from Leveland. Had people from Midland and Leveland and San Angelo. It's just been a pretty good little meeting. So I hope it's been beneficial to y'all as well. Well, we have one final topic left in our book. So we are now up to almost the last page, the James principle. And it's going to seem for a little while that you think I may be wandering around in the wilderness, because we're going to talk in Luke. And we're going to talk in Matthew, but yet the principle is called the James principle. And I've struggled with the title of this one, but I think this is probably the most powerful one of all. And so I want to have a good title. So if we can think of something besides James, feel free to throw your two cents worth in. And so we're going to look at Luke. We're going to look at Matthew. We're going to talk about James. So the obvious starting point for a text, obviously, is the book of Romans. Right? Makes perfect sense. But for a text, we're going to go Romans 12 and 1. Let's see if I can do this one by memory. As we've seen in our old trivia games, I'm not too good at this. I beseech you, therefore, by the mercies of God, that you present yourselves a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And we're going to start with that verse, because there's something in it that I think a lot of people are being misled by in the religious world today. And that's where we're going to begin our study of the James principle. Before we go further, we go to God in prayer. Well, it's not quite fair that y'all had to sit through three lessons, and Dan's going to get the 22nd version of each of the first three. Because here's what we studied. Remember the Cain principle. So hopefully you have that written down in your big box here, the Cain principle. So maybe a couple years from now, you'll have this book sitting somewhere on your notebook and on your dresser, and you're going to remember what we talked about, I hope. Cain principle. There's many ways to handle correction, and most of them are wrong. We get mad, we get upset, we get angry, we get embarrassed, we get defensive, we fight, we deflect, all those things we talked about. And if you can't handle correction, then I'm here to tell you, those of us that can't handle it, we're going to be very difficult children to raise. We're going to be very difficult spouses to live with. We're going to be very difficult employees to work under. If we're a boss that can't handle criticism, we're going to be a very difficult boss to work for. And we're also going to be a very difficult Christian in the eyes of God. So we have to learn how to handle correction and do it in the proper way. Well, if you don't handle correction, the next logical thing is to talk about punishment. You know, we studied this last night with Shiloh. We can either ignore the past, we can ignore punishment, we can pretend like it never happened and just go on about our merry little way, and we're going to come across the same mistakes once again. That's what happened in the story of Shiloh. So we can either ignore the past or we can learn from it, and hopefully we can also learn to learn vicariously from the mistakes of others. And that'd be nice, because then that prevents us from having to do stupid things. We can learn by watching someone else do something stupid. Then we learned the Jeroboam principle. That was this morning. The Jeroboam principle, what happens if you won't accept correction? What happens if you don't learn from other people's mistakes? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You do whatever you feel like doing. And that's what Jeroboam did. But there is a lesson. There is a principle. No one has the right to change the worship that God has ordained, even if the changes are popular and seemingly logical. No one has the right to change God's plan of worship. And so now you might be thinking, well, what does the James principle have to do with any of this? Because I accept correction. And I learn from my past. And I learn from mistakes. And I understand that worship is paramount. And I'm not going to mess with the worship. And I'm going to proudly stand up here and proclaim what we believe to be the truth. What in the world would James have to say to me? And this is where it gets tricky. So I hope you wore some steel-toed boots, because this is the message. We used to call them the Roys. I don't know if you know what that means. That's an old coaching expression. You know, if you have 12 or 13 kids on the basketball team, you say, well, first team, you're going to be offense. And second five, you're going to be defense. And then the rest of you, that's where we got the ROIs, the ROIs, the rest of y'all go, practice free throws or something. And that's kind of the rest of this. We've already talked about all those people that won't accept correction, and we're feeling pretty good because we know we accept correction. We understand how to handle failure, and we stand for the worship, and we're probably feeling pretty good about it. Well, this lesson is for the ROIs. It's for the rest of you. It's for the rest of us. And this is where it gets really tricky. Now, you may wonder why I started Romans 12 and 1. That last phrase, which is your reasonable service. Some of the newer translations have started wording that differently. They have started wording it, which is your spiritual worship. And I disagree with that. I don't think that's talking about worship, because worship and service are not the same thing. I don't know if you've ever thought about that or not. We've just done some study on this back home, and it's becoming more and more clear to me, I think, every time we look at something. That is a mathematical symbol. Not equal. Not congruent. Service does not equal worship. But in a lot of people's minds, they think it does. So they think that anything that they do, I am worshiping God. And I don't think that's the case. I think we have to be very careful of that. In fact, worship in the Bible comes from a certain Greek word, proskuneo, and God must be the sole object of attention. That's the definition of worship. Service comes from a completely different Greek word, lateria, and it says the object of attention is not necessarily God. So we can do acts of service that would not be classified as worship. Kind of a tricky thing. They're definitely related, but there is some difference between the two. The concepts are related, but they're not the same. And so what happens is, Jeroboam can go up and decide that he wants to set some idols, one at Dan and one at Bethel. And he can set some golden calves there and call that worship. That's not worship, because God was not the center or the object of the affection. Therefore, that is not worship. I can go open the door for someone. That's not worship. That could be an act of service, but it's not an act of worship. And we need to understand those two things, because now it seems in the religious world today, those two ideas are getting mixed together more and more and more. Forget worship service. You know, forget what you do in the worship service. We're gonna have a big celebration instead, and we're going to call that worship. It's not the same. Worship and service are not the same. So I got to study this. Have you ever noticed this? Remember Daniel had Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? And no, I don't remember their Hebrew names, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You remember what got them in trouble? Because every time those trumpets blew, they were supposed to fall down and worship this statue that had been set up. And a couple of Jews got mad at them because they wouldn't do it. It says, O king, have they not paid due regard to you? They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image. See, they separated it. There's service and worship. I don't think I ever noticed that before. Worship actually comes from a root word that means to bow down. That's what worship means, to bow down. And he said, not only will they not worship, they won't bow down, they also don't serve your gods. In their daily lives, they were not serving these foreign gods. Found it again in 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 7, 19 and 20. But if you turn away and forsake my statutes and my commandments which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them. See how it's split it? Serve and worship are two different concepts. And I think we need to be careful of that. Have you ever met the fellow that says, well, I'm not going to be at worship service on Sunday. I'm going to be out fishing. And I feel as though I can be closer to God out on the lake, or I can be closer to God, I can worship God better in the mountains. That's not the case. You may be able to serve God in a certain way, but that's not worship. Worship has a set and precise object, and that is to adore and give obeisance to God. That's the purpose of worship. Whereas service is a little different. I came across a tract by Ronnie Wade. And Ronnie Wade split it up like this. He has worship and service. He says worship is towards God, whereas service is towards mankind. It's the way we live our lives and the way we treat each other, especially fellow members of the church. Worship is internal. It's something we talk about, faith and belief and admonition.
Service is external. You see it. It's what we do for others. Worship, I like this one. Worship is vertical. It goes up from us to God. Whereas service is horizontal. It's amongst us. It's amongst the people. Worship is discreet. Service is continuous. And that's kind of some mathematical terms there. But discreet means it's an individual specific event. That when we're going to worship and we come to worship, that has a purpose. Now, if we go out and we help somebody who needs, you know, something happened to their house and we're going to go out there and help them, folks, that's not worship. Not worship. It's something we do all the time. It's how we should be. That's service. You might think, well, that's kind of a confusing beginning. Stay with me, because that is at the heart of the James principle. Both worship and service are expected from Christians. But I believe it's very important that we keep these two concepts separate. So I might ask you the question, do you think it's possible to emphasize, put too much emphasis on the worship and neglect service? Yes, I think it is. And I see it all the time. There's a lot of folks that they will make it to service on Sunday morning because they feel like that's their obligation. And they will worship in a way that they believe is truthful and in spirit and in truth. But their lives, there's no service. They show up to the church, but that's about it. Is it possible to place too much emphasis on worship and not on service? I say yes. Let me flip around. Is it possible to put too much emphasis on the service and not enough on our worship? Yeah, I see that in the religious world all the time. It's all about doing these different social activities. A lot of times they can call it the social gospel. And it's all about doing social things and trying to help mankind. Let me tell you, there's nothing wrong with that. But you better place the same amount of emphasis on your worship and how we worship God. Because if not, it's not meaningful. So there's your two questions. Is it possible to place too much emphasis on proper worship to God and neglect service towards mankind? I think the answer is yes. Number two, is it possible to place too much emphasis on service towards mankind and neglect the proper worship to God? I think the answer is yes. God expects both out of His children. And that's what we're going to talk about with the James principle. I have three examples we're going to consider. One is the rich man. And these are all stories that you've heard and are familiar with. We're not going to spend a tremendous amount of time on any of them. And that comes from Luke chapter 16. Then we're going to talk about the wicked, lazy servant from Matthew 25. And then down at the bottom of the chapter, the goats on the left. And that's the three stories we're going to look at for a little while this evening. And it'll go fast. But you might just end up looking at these stories a little bit differently when we get done. Anyway, that's my goal. That's my hope. All right, here's the rich man. Luke chapter 16. There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and in fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. But there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sore. So it was that the beggar died. And he was carried by angels to Abraham's bosom. And then the rich man also died and was buried. And being in torments in Hades, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. So we've heard this story 100 times. So we might ask the question, you know it's in your book, where did Lazarus live? I don't know where his formal abode was. I know where he was living in this account. It said he was living outside the gate of the rich man. So he was, I guess, what we would call a vagrant. He was homeless. As far as I can tell, I don't think he had a place to really call his own. It says that he was laid every morning, I suppose, up at the gate of the rich man. The rich man, we don't know a tremendous amount about him. We know that he fared sumptuously every day. So I suppose that means that, well, he was rich. It says that he wore this fine linen. So I suppose we could tell he had nice wardrobe, had nice clothes. And he ate enough. He ate well. In fact, he had crumbs left over. I have it all for you now. So Lazarus here is a poor vagrant. It says he's covered with sores. And the dogs are coming up licking his sores. And he lives outside the gate of the rich man. Now we often give the rich man a hard time. And we look at him in a very negative light. And we compare Lazarus and the rich man as though Lazarus, you know, is way up here and the rich man is just a terrible person. But let me ask you something. If you walk out your house one day and you saw some vagrant, disease-infested vagrant with sores and stuff all over him laying outside your front door, what would you do? At least he allowed Lazarus to remain outside his gate and eat his crumbs. You know, the rich man didn't do anything wrong. He didn't mistreat Lazarus. I guarantee you, I know the answer. What I would say, I'm not too proud to admit it, but would you have called the police on Lazarus? If I walked outside and I have a bunch of little kids in my house that I'm responsible for and I'm concerned with, and I look out there on the gate and every morning there's a vagrant, there's a bum sitting outside my house waiting for food, not even enough initiative to get up and go get a job, that'd probably be the thought that would come through my head. Would we have called the police on Lazarus? So before we hammer the rich man too much, let me tell you, he at least allowed Lazarus to stay where he was. And he didn't have a problem, it doesn't sound like, with the crumbs going to Lazarus. He didn't prevent that from happening. So maybe we've got to look at the rich man in a little bit different light now. So think about that. Well, finally, they both died. And it says, Lazarus is up in Abraham's bosom. The rich man is in torment. He cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. Remember what Abraham said to him? He goes, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus, evil things. But now he is comforted, and you are tormented. And how the tables got turned. But have you ever had a little bit of sympathy for the rich man? And as I got thinking about it, maybe I should. What did the rich man do that was so wrong? Was it because he had a nice house? Was it because he had nice clothes? Was it because he had food? Was it and I start searching my mind. What did the rich man do wrong? Did he just place too much emphasis on his money and on his lifestyle? I don't know. But the Bible really does not specify anything heinous that he did. So keep that in your mind. There's number one. Number two, what about the wicked, lazy servant? And so now we're going to flip over to Matthew chapter 25. And that tells a story. Sometimes we call this the parable of the talents. Matthew 25 tells us in verse 14, For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country, who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his own ability. And immediately he went on a journey. Then he who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them, and made another 5 talents. And likewise, he who had received 2 gained 2 more also. But he who had received 1 went and dug in the ground and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them. How many talents did each man return to his master? It says here in question 2. Well, first of all, it gets me to understand, especially since we've got some youngins in the house, talents equal money. Okay, talents was a way of saying their money. So if it makes more sense, turn that into dollars. That the master came and he handed $5 to one, he handed $2 to another, and he handed $1 to the third. How many dollars did he return, did he receive when he returned? Well, it says the first man, he took the 5 and he invested it. Somehow, he did some wheeling and dealing and some trading and some bartering. Somehow, he turned his $5 into $10. And then we have another man who took his $2 and he wheeled and dealed and did what he needed to do and he got $4. So far we have $14 have been returned. And then we get to the third servant. He took his dollar, made sure he didn't lose it, took care of it, hid it in the ground. And then the master came back. He took that dollar bill back, crisp dollar bill, dusted it off and handed it back to him. So the man received $15 total. Or 15 talents, as we would say in the reading. So how many talents did each man return to his master? Well, we had 10, 4, and 1. What did he say to the man who turned the 5 into 10? What did he say to the man who took the 2 and made it 4? He said, Well done, you good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. But what about the third servant? What about the servant who had 1 talent and that's all that he had? He returned what he was given. How much? What was his response? Because I'll be honest with you. If I loan somebody a shovel, you know what I expect to get back? A shovel. He loaned a dollar. He gave him a dollar. What did he expect to get back? Well, he got his dollar back. He didn't lose any money. Nobody stole from him. But what did the master say? But his Lord answered and said to him, "You wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my counting I would have received back my own with interest." And the man is shocked. He says, "My Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours." He didn't steal it. He didn't take anything from him. He said, "Here, I took care of the dollar. I didn't want to lose it. So here's your talent back. Here's exactly what you gave me. We're square. We're even. I didn't lose anything." But the Lord called him wicked and lazy. So I thought about this for a little bit. I want you to think of the word wicked. Okay, Drew and Aaron have already seen this, so not allowed to say. But I want you to come up with someone from history. When you think of someone wicked, who do you think of when you think of the most wicked person you can ever imagine? Who is it? I Googled it. You can find everything on Google. I Googled the 10 most wicked people in history, and these two people came up on every list that I found. So I want to see if maybe we think alike. You recognize either of those two scoundrels? That's little Charlie Manson on the left. You talk about a wicked, wicked man. Head of that cult out in California in the 60s, killed all those innocent people. He is crazy as they come. He's a wicked man, has no conscience whatsoever. And then this guy over here, that's old Adolf Hitler. He's number one on every list I found, was Hitler. You know, was behind the massacre of those 6 million Jews and entered the world into a tremendous war, killed all millions and millions of people. Just a wicked, horrible man, and so were all of his henchmen under him. They were just horrible people. That's wicked, right? Those are wicked people. Do you picture the man described by Jesus? Do you picture him as being wicked? "I gave you a dollar, and you returned a dollar to me." Is that how we would classify wicked? Because he just returned what was given? I'm telling you, if I loan somebody something and I get it back in basically the same condition, I'm pretty happy with them. But you know what the Lord said? He said, "No, you're lazy and you're wicked." Interesting story. Story number three. The goats on the left. So skip down to Matthew chapter 25, we get to about verse 31. "When the Son of Man comes on in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats." So remember how the story goes? We're going to have the sheep on the right, and we're going to have the goats on the left. And it says, "To the sheep on the right, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." What a great statement to the sheep. What statement was given to the goats? Now, the sheep were a little bit concerned. Now, they didn't really understand why they were being given such, you know, props, why they were being spoken to in such high regard. And he says, "For I was hungry and you gave me food. Says, I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." And remember what they said? Well, we don't remember any of that. When did that happen? When did we ever say that? When did we ever clothe you? When did we ever find you naked? When did we ever find you hungry? Remember what he says? The Lord says, "Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." And the sheep on the right are congratulated, and they're given this great response for the life that they live. And then he turns to the goats on the left. "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels." That was the condemnation of the goats. Why? What was the reason? The question I have here, what reason was given for the condemnation of the goats? What did they do wrong? Well, he says, "For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you did not take me in, naked and you did not clothe me, sick and in prison and you did not visit me. So what reason was given for the condemnation of the goats? They did not do things. They did not do things. What did they do wrong? What command did they break? What horrible thing did they do wrong? Not so much what they did, it's what they didn't do. And that's where things get scary. So let's talk about our three lessons here. Now you may have come across a commentator. He's an old Church of Christ preacher. I believe he was a Cups in classes, but his name is Guy in Woods. And he is one of the most prolific writers. He calls these judgment parables. And so I tend to shy away from that word, because when we start talking about the rich man and Lazarus, is that a parable or is that an account? I know Eric was talking about that the other night. I have a tendency to kind of lean towards that was an actual event, that it wasn't a parable like these other two stories were. But whatever the case, these are all examples, I think we can agree, of judgment. Here's the question. For what were they condemned? So this is what we have to listen to, and I hope this makes sense. What was the rich man condemned for? Did he injure Lazarus? Did he assault Lazarus? Did he kick him when he was down? Did he spit on him? Did he yell at him, scream at him, hit him? No. Did he break any laws? Not that we're told of. Was his wealth a sin? I mean, there's rich people in the Bible all over the place. Was his wealth a sin? And what I'm looking at is, what was the rich man condemned for? He didn't hurt Lazarus. In fact, he helped take care of Lazarus in a way. He allowed him a place to stay. He allowed him to eat the crumbs from his table. What did the rich man do that was worthy of condemnation? Now, we may not know the whole story. He may have been a sorry scoundrel. I don't know. But from what we have in the Bible, kind of hard to pin down what the rich man did wrong. Likewise, what did the wicked, lazy servant, what did he do wrong? Did he steal the money from his master? Was he corrupt? Was he deceitful and deceptive? Actually, he was very honest, wasn't he? The master came back and he said, "Whoa, I was scared." He said, he admitted it. He said, "I was scared and I took your money and I hid it. And here I'm giving you back exactly what you gave me." What did the wicked, lazy servant do wrong? What was his mistake? What was his downfall? What caused him to have condemnation? Pretty tough, isn't it? What about the goats on the left? What did the goats on the left do wrong? Did they lie, cheat, steal, commit adultery, or anything of that nature? Doesn't sound like it. Did they hurt anybody else? Account doesn't say it. Were they evil people? I don't think so. What did they do wrong? What was the reason for their condemnation? It is not what they did, it's what they didn't do. And that's what leads us to the James principle. So get ready to write it down. Here we go. You know, many, many years ago, I was talking with Megan about this a couple weeks ago, but she reminded me many years ago, there was an old song, Steve Warren. He said, "It's not what I did, it's what I didn't do." And that is the James principle. All three of our accounts, none of them were condemned for evil acts they had done. They were condemned for the righteous acts they did not do in all three accounts. I can't tell you that the rich man beat up Lazarus and kicked him and stabbed him and left him to die. It's not the case. What was he condemned for? Because he had good things in his life and Lazarus had nothing, and he wasn't willing to share it. Maybe more than just a couple crumbs on the spot to lay down. It's not what he did. It's what he didn't do. What about the wicked, lazy servant? Did he steal, cheat, lie, deceive? No, he just didn't work. He didn't stay the course. He didn't necessarily do anything wrong. He just didn't do enough things that were right. He didn't work hard enough. And he said, you're lazy. You didn't try to improve on what you were given. The goats on the left, they didn't cheat, lie, steal. They just didn't fulfill their obligations of service towards each other. It's not that they did anything specifically wrong. They just didn't do enough that was right. And that scares me to death. That's very sobering. Because people were condemned not for their failure in worship, but they were condemned for their lack of service. And that's scary. Because we talked about Jeroboam this morning, and we understand how we stand up for the truth when it comes to worship. And if anyone comes in here and tries to change the way the worship is, then we're going to go right back to the scriptures, and we're going to determine what is the right and proper way to do worship as best as we can. And then we'll go home, and we'll feel so good about ourselves for standing up for the truth and standing up for worship. But then do we do any service? Do we do anything the rest of our time? Do our lives show actions of a servant Christian? Or are we kind of like the goats on the left? We didn't necessarily do anything wrong this week, but to the people that were hungry, we didn't feed them. And the people that were thirsty, well, we didn't give them drink. To the people that were naked, we didn't give them any clothes. You know, there was the actions that we didn't do. And how scary is that? Because now I'm talking to everybody, myself included. Do we do enough? I hope every morning at 10:30 on Sunday morning, I can have confidence that there's going to be a group assembled here to worship properly. And I hope, I believe at 10:30 in Leveland on Sunday morning, I hope there's a group that will assemble to worship correctly. San Angelo, Midland, Amarillo, Odessa, wherever it might be, that people will assemble together to worship correctly. You know what I'm just as concerned is? Are we also going to be showing acts of service, one towards another, towards our fellow Christians, towards our fellow neighbors, the rest of the time? Because they're just as evil. So you're telling me that you can be condemned not for unrighteous acts, but for righteous acts that you don't do? And that certainly appears what the Lord is saying. That we have a responsibility not only for worship, but also for service. So you might be wondering, what in the world does all of this have to do with James? Why is this called the James Principle? And I'll tell you, pretty much it's because Terry's dad, Terry, you all know Terry Harris, gave a lesson a couple weeks ago on James 1 and 22 about being doers of the word. And I said, that's exactly what James was trying to get across to the people who are reading his epistle, is it not? So you might be wondering, what in the world does this have to do with James? This is what it is. James 1 and 22. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. We are supposed to hear the word and then act upon it. We're not supposed to hear the word, say amen, congratulate the preacher, and then go home and live our lives how we want to. We are to be doers of the word, not just hearers. That's the idea behind the James Principle. Had the rich man, had he lived that life a little different, had he done some of those acts of service, you know, that story may have turned out very, very differently. If those goats on the left, if they had given people water when they were thirsty, and given them food when they were hungry, they would have gotten a different response. Well, then I kept looking through the book of James. You know what? I found a whole bunch of them. James 1 and 27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. You mean we have to do something? Yes. We have work that we are supposed to do. Now, if you remember, if you've kind of studied church history, the book of James was a big old controversy for a man by the name of Martin Luther. And he was one of the big people in the Reformation. He did not like the book of James. In fact, he wanted the book of James kicked out because it was the whole question of faith versus works. And I'm convinced now that what got Martin Luther was he didn't understand the difference of works being as opposed to worship versus service. Yes, we are responsible for works. We are to act a certain way. What's it profit? James asks in chapter 2, verse 14. What's it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? What works is he talking about? I think he's talking about the works one to another. How we treat one another. We can say we have faith all day long and we believe in Jesus Christ as our Lord. But if we don't act like Jesus, and if we don't treat people the way that Jesus treated people, do we really have faith? If we don't have the works to show for it, do we really have faith? James 4 and 17. You're not going to believe this. The clicker just died again. James 4 and 17. This is one of our questions here. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is a sin. So what's the responsibility of those that know to do good? Well, I'll tell you, it's to do it. If you know to do good, then you need to do it. That's our responsibility. That's what we're supposed to do. And I'm not talking about the organized, assembled worship of the church. I'm talking about every day when we have opportunity to do good, we need to do good. So in conclusion, we are the rich man. We have the wicked, lazy servant. And we have the goats on the left. What did they do wrong? Why were all three of these condemned? I'll tell you why they were condemned. They were condemned because they were hearers only. They were not doers of the word. They didn't necessarily do anything wrong, that I can tell. They didn't commit a lot of negative acts, but they just did not do what they were supposed to do. They were doers and not hearers. We must learn to equate our service to one another with our worship to God. Because is it possible to place too much emphasis on worship and neglect the service? And I think the answer is yes. I think that's something we all need to be very careful of, because that's something that can truly get us into trouble. So I'm going to leave you with one more thought. Everybody has homework tonight. I want you to pick up your Bible, and I want you to turn to James chapter 5. And I want you to read James chapter 5. And he's going to start out by talking about rich people. And then he's going to go to another section where he's going to talk about people that just didn't do what they were supposed to. They didn't finish the fight. And then he's going to talk about people that didn't take care of one another. And he talks about, you know, if someone has a problem, pray for them. And I want you to read that, but I want you to think of it in relation to the rich man, the wicked, lazy servant, and the goats on the left. And it's almost like James is writing chapter 5 to those three groups. It's amazing. Think about it. Our worship is very, very important. I'll never take anything away from the importance of our worship. But I think we need to place just as much emphasis on our service. Because what is the James principle? Is that we can be condemned not for doing unrighteous acts, but for not doing righteous acts. And that's a very scary and powerful message to end our service with this evening.